Support for Radioactive comes from the members of the Unitarian Universalist Church of Ellsworth on the Bucksport Road, with Sunday services at 10:30 a.m., affirming and promoting respect for the interdependent web of existence and the goal of world community with peace, liberty, and justice for all.
It's just about 15 seconds before 4 o'clock, and you are tuned to WERU-FM, 89.9 Blue Hill, 102.9 Bangor, and streaming online all around the world at WERU.org. Radioactive is up next.
Meredith DeFrancesco. This is Radioactive, a grassroots environmental and social justice news journal with Meredith DeFrancesco and Amy Brown for May 10th, 2007. Sweeping government commando-style raids of factories employing suspected undocumented immigrants has been on the increase across the United States, illustrating a philosophy that treats undocumented people as dangerous criminals. Immigration Customs Enforcement, known as ICE, has been pursuing a militaristic policy outlined by its overseeing body, the Department of Homeland Security. In the middle of March, New Bedford, Massachusetts, was the location of an ICE raid, which rounded up 360 people at their workplace. The leather goods factory Michael Bianco and Corporate has been noted by labor rights watchdogs for its substandard labor conditions. Its primary manufacturing contract is with the U.S. military, making such goods as backpacks. Of those arrested and detained, the majority were from Guatemala or El Salvador. The manner in which ICE has carried out arrests and detentions has raised many concerns regarding civil and human rights. Arms drawn, ICE forces have entered workplaces, rounded up people with force, arresting them, shackling them, and placing them on buses headed for immediate deportation. Legal consult and translation have been inadequate or absent. Many of those arrested are forced to leave young children in school or daycare without ability to make contact. Many of those arrested at the New Bedford factory were single mothers. Testimony from those arrested also documents the manner in which people were transported by plane and held in detention, shackled, treated with force, and without adequate warmth, food, and sleep. Questions have been asked by legal and civil rights organizations that challenge the Department of Homeland Security's working principle that equates undocumented immigrants as threats to national security. In the immigration equation, one factor is continually absent from the national and global debate. This is the effect neoliberal economic rules, manifested through free trade policies and organizations, have on poorer countries throughout the world. Free trade and privatization have increased the poverty and decreased the ability to make a living in many areas, most explicitly in the agricultural sector. Markets are flooded with cheap imports, which make small farmers' products obsolete. The effects on Mexico, predicted by many before NAFTA, have now been well documented. The effects of free trade have been similar throughout Latin America, provoking massive immigration to city centers and to the United States by people looking for a means to support their families. 2 weeks ago, we spoke with John Wilshire Carrera from the Greater Boston Legal Services, one of the organizations advocating for the rights of those immigrants arrested in New Bedford. We bring you part of that interview today on Radioactive. Comment on how it was handled by ICE, if you want to starting from there.
On March 6th, early in the morning, officials from the Department of Homeland Security, actually about 600, descended upon a factory, a Bianco factory in New Bedford, and basically encircled the factory and then rushed into the factory. Many of the first officers had their faces covered, and additionally, after that, a number of officers came in with guns. They arrested people who were working. They put great fear into a lot of people. And for the rest of the day, they had them lined up, asking them questions, handcuffed, and unable to deal with the rest of the world. They then took these, of the 520 people or so working in the factory, they ended up detaining about 361 people. And at the end of the day, they ended up taking about 340 to an army base that has been closed down, but that in fact still houses a number of federal buildings and complexes, and they detained people there for the next 2 days. While there, we've heard from people who've now been released that in reality most people didn't sleep at all, that they were processed for 2 days. They were taken, put in lines, they were fingerprinted, they were questioned, and when they were moved from building to building, they were shackled, and they were bound together in groups of five or six, and moved from one building to the other. And it was a very, 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 very traumatizing experience. At the end of one day, a plane load was moved to Texas of people, and they eventually ended up in Harlingen, Texas. At the end of the second day, another plane load was moved to Texas, and they ended up in El Paso. But there was a group who were kept in Massachusetts, and that was just about 100, and they included people who were Salvadorans, and the government was unable to move them because of a permanent injunction that had been put into place by a court in California in the late 80s, ordering the government not to move people for at least 7 days after being arrested, which is what you would think would be the case for everybody.
Why did it only apply to those people?
It only applied to them because they were Salvadorans, and the injunction came out of a lawsuit raising concerns about Salvadoran refugees who had come to the United States and had been denied asylum and had actually been moved in these similar ways from place to place, denying them their due process rights to put on their claims. So as a result of it, the court in California issued this permanent injunction, and because of that, the government wasn't able to move the Salvadorans within the group. Now, of the people who were picked up, at the 340-somewhat people, really starting with the 360, by now, because of the effort of the Department of Social Services in Massachusetts, in conjunction with the efforts of the New Bedford community and the legal community, about 90 people who were basically mothers and fathers who were directly dependent upon very small children and or women that were very pregnant or young minors were released. In addition to that, since then, a number of people in Massachusetts have been bonded out, because in Massachusetts we have been able to get representation for this community. We have been able to go to the prisons. The community has been able to respond. The families have been able to respond. However, the people in Texas are in a very different situation. And just simply being in Texas means that they're far away from their families. They're far away from their community. There is very hard to get lawyers out there because they're in places that process large numbers of people. Even though they're good lawyers out there, there are large detention centers with over 1,000 people, so it's very hard to get representation. And it's even very hard to make calls out, and attorneys cannot make calls in. And so for all those reasons, knowing what we know, because we do this work, we realize that by the U.S. government moving them out so quickly, in fact, they were denying them their right to due process. Under the statute, individuals have a right to a lawyer at no cost to the government, which means that they can get a lawyer, they can get represented. They also have a right to participate in the development and the presentation of their claim. So by sending people out, we realized that those rights were being denied, and so we went to federal court just before the second plane left, and we filed a habeas and a request for an application for injunctive relief to stop the United States government from removing the people, and they had removed them, but also to get them, to bring them back, so that in fact in Massachusetts they can be represented and their due process rights can be adhered to. Since then, a number of different things have happened, and one of the things that happened was that the government at one point said, look, a number of people have been ordered removed while they were in Texas, and they have waived their rights to appeal, which means they really want to go home. They're volunteering to go home, and we took the position, because we had been in touch with the community and their families, that in most situations, the individuals who were out there did not want to go home. Many had reasons making it very hard or dangerous for them to go home. So the judge heard us, and he basically said, all right, send some lawyers to Texas to find out what's really going on. So myself and a number of people in my office, including some other lawyers from Catholic Social Services, et cetera, went down to Texas, and we interviewed basically 75 people. And these are people who had been before judges and had been ordered removed and had not reserved their right to appeal. So we went to find out what was going on. What we found out in speaking to individuals over a period of 3 days, very intensive interviews, was that, in fact, they were overwhelmed by the whole experience of being picked up at the factory, been mistreated, been taken over to Fort Devens, and been processed for 1 or 2 days in a way that was, for them, very traumatizing and very humiliating, and then flown to Texas under conditions which, for them, were incredibly humiliating. Treated, like many said, like animals, being treated like terrorists, etc. These are people who, you know, are working class people. I don't think any of them that I have met or I've learned of has a criminal history at all. The people who pay their taxes, people who are fathers and mothers. These are the working class of our communities. And so they basically explained to us that when it came time to go to before a judge, you know, they didn't quite, many of them don't speak Spanish either. They speak Maya Quiche. A number of them do speak Spanish, but they were so overwhelmed. They went into court. They were asked questions that made them feel like from the very beginning of coming into the United States, the government considered them to be doing things that were very bad and criminal-like. And so by the time it came to deciding whether they were going to contest their removability after the judge had ordered them removed, they decided they had no rights in this country. They were overwhelmed. What else could they do? So they didn't do anything. Some people didn't understand the process at all. And so as a result of that, you know, these individuals really, of the 75 that we saw, 54 said, no, we didn't give up our right to appeal knowingly and voluntarily. And 21 said, you know, a number of them said, we did, but the truth is we're too overwhelmed with what's going on. We have no rights in this country. We want to go home. And some of them said, you know, it was an overwhelming experience, but the truth is I've got a child that I really have to see, or my mother's very sick, so I'm going to go. So 54 decided that they really wanted to stay and fight, and 21 decided that it was time to go home because they couldn't take it anymore.
So prior to their court dates, they were not receiving, either in Texas or here or in Massachusetts, any sort of access to legal counsel or translation services?
Well, what happened was that at one point, in terms of the translation services, at one point one of the judges raised the question as to what languages or what Mayan dialects individuals spoke, and a number of people spoke out and said, this is my, Quiche is my Mayan dialect, for example. But when it came down to it, they didn't get Mayan interpreters. So that's, in terms of the language, a lot of people that we spoke to, I'm a Spanish speaker, and it took a while to really sort of, you know, there's a superficial understanding of what people say, but sometimes it's not very deep because it's another language. Their primary language is another language. So that's a huge issue for a lot of the cases. There was even a person who was almost totally deaf and also was mainly Mayan speaker, and so he didn't understand things at all. So there was a number of different stories like that, and some people were very traumatized. In fact, most were. So there was that. In terms of getting access to legal services, I mean, there were notices that are posted out, but again, you're dealing with organizations that are listed as legal services organizations that deal with very large numbers of people, and some of the organizations were actually very far away from the detention centers. And a number of people told us that, you know, they did see people. Some of them said that they saw some people who came in, but it was after their hearings in some cases. In some cases, before their hearings, they didn't quite understand what was going on. But in reality, they, you know, it took a long time, and the group presentations were made. And the truth is, these are individuals and communities, because I do this work all the time, where you really need to sit down and you need to have a one-to-one discussion. You need to work things through. People need to be able to trust you. It's hard to have a quick conversation about very complex issues. A lot of people will say yes to things because they're too embarrassed to tell you that they don't know. But in fact, they're under incredible pressure, and they're really, you know, it's very, very hard. And so there was lists. Some people did see some people, but in reality, clearly, as somebody who's done this work for a long time,
it was inadequate.
I feel that, you know, they didn't get effective representation. They didn't get effective advice by lawyers, and most of them didn't get it at all, you know. And so now, more recently, we had a hearing last week, and the thing that's been very interesting for me, because, I mean, again, I do this work, is that more and more the community in New Bedford is aware of, so there's this hearing in federal court. A number of people from the community came. Each time, more and more people come. And I think it's become something where, in reality, we're dealing with some of the original inhabitants of the Americas. You know, it's sort of like the immigrants trying to deport the original Americans, you know. And so I think a lot of people realize that in fact, so much of why they're here and who they are comes from the fact that they come from indigenous communities in Guatemala, for example. And they've been targeted. You know, there was genocides in the early 80s, and they've been targeted ever since because they are indigenous people who sort of stand up for their way of living and for their collectivity. And so here now more and more people are understanding that it's important to be open about your Mayan ethnicity. So each time we have hearings, more and more people are showing up as indigenous people, and it's an incredible experience. So the last thing that happened is we had this hearing on Thursday, which was a very important hearing.
On April 19th,
involving issues of jurisdiction. And there was an interest, I mean, both sides ended up presenting. And at the end of the hearing, the judge continued the stay for 54 people. He had earlier, when he had ordered us to Texas, he said, find out what's going on. We came back. We informed the court that 54 people said they didn't want to leave. He issued an injunction so that a stay of removal, okay, so that the government couldn't remove them. At the end of this hearing, he continued that stay. And he also agreed that if, for some reason, the case does not go forward, and we do, and we appeal it because we made it clear that if he denied the case, we would appeal it. He agreed that if that was the case, he would protect these 54 people. So I think one very important thing is that although the judge, it's taken a while for the judge, I think, to really understand things and to sort of connect with the case, he now understands that he's dealing with individuals who've gone through a lot, and at the very least, he's got 54 people who depend on him for safety and for justice. And so I think this is an important step, and we're now waiting to go forward. We have to brief some issues, and he will make his decision at some point as he's going to dismiss the case or not. We feel very strongly the law's on our side, and he's not going to. But I think, very importantly, he's now understanding the humanity of the whole thing, and he's starting to feel that he, you know, that there are individuals. It's not just the quote-unquote illegal aliens, that these are real individuals who are working-class people who are part of our community.
Mm-hmm. In the case you refer to, has it been broken up on an individual case-by-case basis, or is it a suit that includes all of the people?
Well, the suit includes all of the people, and it's particularly aimed at people who've been removed out of the state, all right? But it includes all of the people. That's one effort. Now, the government has been arguing, well, you know, what has to happen is that we're in the wrong court. We should really be in the Court of Appeals down the road, that each person should pursue their claim, and then we should appeal it up the line the way we normally do it. We're saying, no, this is sort of a pattern and practice situation where the government is denying the constitutional and statutory rights of these people as a whole, as a class. And so this case is about the group as a whole, and it's not about the individual cases. There's a lot of work being done on the individual cases, but this suit is not about that.
Mm-hmm. Can you comment on this increasing trend of these sorts of ICE raids and the human rights issues that are brought up when these raids have been continuing to occur, and also a comment on U.S. immigration policy?
Sure. One thing that we've learned from this, I mean, I've been doing this work for many years, but one thing I've learned is that there is an element within Homeland Security, within ICE, you know, U.S. ICE, which is the department which is responsible for detention and removal, that really believes in what is called, in something that has been captured as the end game strategy, which was a strategy plan that was published by ICE in 2003. I'm not saying everybody believes in it, because I do believe that there are a lot of people who do this work, who know it's important that they do this work, but there is a way in which they understand that immigrants are an important element of the society, and they just can't willy-nilly do things to people because they are people, okay? But there is this element that is saying, no, we have a strategy, and whatever it's going to take, we're going to do it, regardless of what it takes, regardless of the humanity involved. And that's what I believe happened here, is that they picked these individuals up, they decided they were going to process them out of state as quickly as possible, and they did whatever they had to do that, regardless of the needs of the individuals or the trauma or the stress that it imposed upon these people. It was like, you know, you're moving objects. And I think that's, to me, that is something that's very alarming in the sense that, you know, it's a reflection of what's happened in this country after 9/11, where, in fact, you know, the government claims it has a right to do anything because we're in a time of war. And because of that, it decides on a course of action, and it does it, whether it's rendition, whether it's holding people in Guantanamo, whatever it is, whatever they decide to do is what it is, and whatever's going to get the job done, they do it, regardless of the human rights violations, regardless of the toll that it takes on the individuals that they're involved, regardless of the amount of money that it takes to do things, they just do it. I mean, we're in a country that in many ways is in debt up to its ears, and yet they brought in 600 officers to do this operation. It cost them a fortune, I'm sure. And it's not like I'm saying, you know, an individual had an idea of, you know, not letting somebody sleep for 3 days is torture, as far as I'm concerned. I do a lot of asylum claims, and if somebody raised that in their claim, to me it sounds like torture. Well, I don't think individuals meant to torture people doing this, but in reality, that's the effect of what they did. They did not consider some of the individuals who were planning this forgot the humanity of the whole thing, and it was like you're processing, you know, goods or something like that, and the end result has been something that for me is incredibly troubling, because it goes against the basic principles of this country, which is, you know, that this is a country of people. And so, and we're all created equal. And clearly, if you think this way, then we're not all created equal. I mean, there are some people who, you know, get to run the show, and the other people have to put up with whatever it is because they're not even people. And so, in this particular case, what they've done is, under the rubric of enforcing, you know, immigration law and coming down on a bad employer, they've ended up, you know, hurting and harming not only these 361 people, but their children, their families. What's clear to me as New Bedford is that it was like the 300 people had disappeared. The fabric of society in New Bedford was severely, you know, ruffled. And if these same people continue to pursue these policies in the hopes, with the goal of deporting 10 million people in 10 years, which is what their goal is according to this plan, that means all our cities, all our towns are going to be ripped up in this way. And it, to me, it's, you know, if you do that, it's devastating for society because, you know, I mean, if you follow what's going on in other parts of the world, when these type of things happen, people turn on each other. Society starts falling apart, and the end result is devastating.
This
is how I feel about it.
The 10 million in 10 years, who articulated that?
It's Department of Homeland Security, mm-hmm. in a strategy plan that they put out in 2003. And it comes from a commission that was set up on, I believe, in September of 2001 to address similar types of issues. So it's like, you know, I mean, what is it, the final solution for the immigrants? I don't know. But it's something that is very scary. And I know a lot of people within the government don't agree with this, you know, including within ICE.
John, do you want to comment on U.S. immigration policy and where you or your organization sees might be a positive way for it to go?
So at this point in time, obviously, this country is trying to decide which way it's going to go, you know. And I think one thing that's come out of, that's become very clear in the last 5 years, and I think this raid has made it much clearer, is that, in fact, a special set of rules have been developed as to how you deal with people who are, quote-unquote, foreign-born and in this country and not permanent residents or citizens. And it's an apartheid. And so I think one decision is, are we going to go down that road of apartheid? I mean, South Africa had passed laws. They controlled how people work. They controlled where they live, and this is exactly what I think has been set up for immigrants, particularly immigrants who are not permanent residents and citizens. And so, one path is to go down that path, build many more detention centers, find more ways to bring police into everybody's lives, find more ways to criminalize a community that is attempting to live and work. And eventually, I think to put people in a position where they're less, you know, they're just by being a human being and being in this country, there are criminals. Okay, or we go in another direction, which is we try to resolve this in a way that truly is harmonious with what's going on in the world. The world is being turned upside down because of free trade agreements, because of neoliberalism, because of privatization, because of all sorts of things.
Yep.
And so instead of building walls like they're doing, like they now propose in Iraq, the new way should be thought through to deal with these issues so that, in fact, the flows of people can be taken into consideration. And when capital investments are made, people truly understand the effects of these capital investments around the world.
Right, because these policies that we continue to pass, so often we don't discuss the immigration issue in conjunction with these free
trade.
Right,
we don't discuss it, and it's sort of left to the walls and the police to deal with. When, in fact, for example, you know, the free trade agreement with Mexico has dropped the price of corn, and a huge number of people have been displaced because of it. So instead of understanding that implication and understanding and helping and sort of thinking ways of dealing with those issues, no. What they do is they displace all sorts of people, then they put up these huge walls, and they call in the police, and they think it's going to resolve it. It's not. It's just not going to resolve it. I mean, the thing that really strikes me about the people who I've met who were detained is that these are working-class people. These are people who cared for their families here, who paid their taxes, who sent money home to care for people there. The factory was making a lot of money because of them. They're very hard workers, and there are people who are very collective and communal. These are not people. These are people you want as your neighbors. These are our neighbors. And so the question is, what are we going to do with this world? This whole world has become this. So it's time now to say, we can't keep on going down this road of apartheid. We can't keep on going down this road of building walls and more prisons. That's not the solution for anything. We got to find another way, and that is, I think, very important for this piece. It's much more than an immigration piece. It's a piece about how you look at the whole world. But it is an immigration piece in the sense that, you know, deputizing the local police is actually going, not only going to make it harder for the individuals who are immigrants, but it's also going to make it hard for everybody else. The police are going to get into everybody's lives. They're going to have to get into everybody's lives because it's a slippery slope, you know. Everybody, suddenly U.S. citizens have to present their birth certificates in order to get Medicaid. Why? Because these rules don't make any sense, and it's just sort of it's criminalizing and militarizing society as a whole. So that's not the way to go. So we have to think of something different.
Are there other issues that you want to add at this point?
One thing that I think is a very important piece that's come out of this for us who are working on these issues is that the operation was originally called Operation United Front by ICE. And what it's turned into, in fact, is a united front against these types of operations. We've seen people from New Bedford, from many sides of New Bedford, with the religious community, the indigenous community, the Latino community, the community of color, and other communities in New Bedford come together on this. We have seen people in the state on a level that we haven't seen in a long time understand this issue and have empathy for the people who were picked up. We have seen lawyers, a lot of private lawyers, a lot of legal services lawyers get involved. We have seen there's an organization called MIRA, who is an immigrant rights organization in the state. It's the main one. They have played an incredibly key role in pulling people together. It's brought people together. The governor of the state is stood up. He's a new governor. The old governor was very anti-immigrant. The new governor stood up and in many ways has made us feel very proud of the state in the sense that it stood up and it said, you don't do this in the state. The rush to the airport was wrong, as the governor said at one point. And so there is a way in which what's coming out of this, I think, is a very powerful piece. Again, this is a moment when, you know, even the rhetoric in the media has been very positive. It's talked about humans instead of, you know, things and criminals, and I think that's a very important point. And I think that comes from the type of people that have been picked up and the strength and the quality of the individuals that we've seen come out of this.
Thanks, John Wilshire Carretta of Greater Boston Legal Services, for joining us today.
Thanks.
For more information concerning the Department of Homeland Security ICE raids in the New Bedford, Massachusetts, Michael Bianco factory, you can go online to the Massachusetts Immigrant and Refugee Advocacy Coalition. The website is www.miracoalition.org. That's miracoalition.org. Additionally, videos on the New Bedford raids and interviews with those detained in Texas can be viewed online on YouTube. In Maine, the Down East League of Women's Voters will sponsor a public program on immigration issues Saturday, May 19th, from noon to 2:30 p.m. at Jasper's Restaurant in Ellsworth. The League says, quote, the May 19th meeting will review reports on issues the National League is studying, including an overview of federal immigration policy and enforcement, the economics of immigration, what motivates immigration, diversity and inclusion issues, and how immigration relates to the effects of global interdependence. Members of the public are encouraged to attend the meeting and participate in the discussion. End of quote. Again, Saturday, May 19th, noon to 2:30 at Jasper's Restaurant in Ellsworth.
And before we end today, we wanted to give you an update. In recent weeks here on WERU, we've been reporting on efforts in Maine to gather 10,000 signatures on petitions calling for the impeachment of Bush and Cheney. The group Maine Impeach has now surpassed that goal of 10,000, joining the growing impeachment movement across the United States. For more information, you can go to maineimpeach.org. And also, next week, thanks to Eric Herder, a video activist in southern Maine who has shared with us the audio, we will be bringing you a talk that took place on April 28th in Portland. David Swanson, founder of AfterDowningStreet.org, spoke in Portland. AfterDowningStreet.org is a pro-impeachment website, and you can check that out as well. We'll have that on Radioactive next week for you. And you've been listening to Radioactive, a grassroots environmental and social justice news journal. I'm Amy Brown.
And I'm Meredith DeFrancesco.
You can reach us here by emailing news@weru.org. Just put Radioactive in the subject line. And you can listen to almost all of WERU's locally produced news and public affairs programs on our website, weru.org.
Thanks for listening and acting. Stay tuned for more independent news.
Radioactive is made possible in part by Artisan Builders, providing environmental design, construction, and renovation for homeowners and local businesses. since 1992. 525-7740.